From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, August 23rd through Friday, August 27th, 2021. It was a week of pain, suffering, conflict, and informational noise. Afghanistan turned into a logistical, humanitarian, and political nightmare. Although most sides agree the U.S. had to get out of there. It's just a matter of how, which obviously leaves the Biden administration holding the bag of blame. Concern over the Delta variant, vaccines, and boosters shared center stage with Afghanistan, followed by ongoing investigations into the January 6th disgrace, whether you want to call it a riot or an insurrection, and Trump's nonstop obsession with the 2020 election being stolen from him amidst a truckload of conspiracy theories is giving the GOP a whole bunch of headaches. Meantime, the Western fires continue to stink up the air all the way to the East Coast. Floods devastate parts of the Midwest. Trade has slowed down at clogged up seaports, sparking inflation. China and Russia continue to be a pain in the butt, and one of the coolest cats in music went on to his rightful place in rock and roll heaven. Stand by as we're about to embark upon a bold hour of Black Belt Talk Radio, in which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view will be tested. We've got lefties, righties, and thoughtful independents waiting in the wings to tickle your brain with notions and emotions. We'll hear from Andrew Langer of WBAL in Baltimore about Afghanistan, Larry Elder in Los Angeles about race relations, the late Phil Valentine of WWTN-FM Nashville about intellectual honesty, Scott James Matheson of WDDQ in Valdosta, Georgia, about being a talk show host and a mayor, and Victoria Jones in the nation's capital with memories of drummer Charlie Watts. Opinionated yappers from across the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations as well as the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation in a fragmented, noisy world in which we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, heard coast to coast and around the world on great radio stations in the U.S. and the U.K., a hyper-verbal examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media and played out in the theater of your mind. Information's gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, the deaths of Rolling Stone drummer Charlie Watts and talk show host Phil Valentine tied with several celebrity legal cases. The iconic drummer of the Rolling Stones passed away at 80, giving talk show hosts the opportunity to reminisce about more than half a century of rock and pop culture sparked by the British invasion.
The radio talk show world mourned the loss of one of its most popular local personalities, Phil Valentine of WWTN-FM in Nashville, due to COVID-19. It fueled a ton of conversation about his role in the vaccine controversy. We'll explore this in depth during the next hour. Also this week, legendary porn star Ron Jeremy was indicted on 34 sex crime charges, and singer R. Kelly faced accusers at his trial for sexual abuse crimes and other alleged felonies.
At number 9, a tie between U.S. relations with China and Russia, the Havana Syndrome, and the postponement of Vice President Harris's trip to Vietnam. America's problems with China continue to escalate as tensions grow over trade, military expansionism, and geopolitics, not to mention the origin and spread of the coronavirus.
Vice President Kamala Harris's visit to Vietnam, in which part of her agenda was to blast Chinese suppression of democracy and its employment of bullying tactics, hit a speed bump due to an outbreak of the so-called Havana Syndrome at the U.S. Embassy, another term for unexplained health incidents, perhaps caused by invisible rays, which American intelligence suspect is the handiwork of the Russians. I know it sounds crazy. Crazy scary.
At number 8 this week, the New York State gubernatorial transition. Former Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul was officially inaugurated as the first woman governor of New York State.
She replaced Andrew Cuomo, from whom she clearly distanced herself and her intended style of governing.
At number 7, wildfires, floods, and climate change. The nation continues to be ravaged by heat, wildfires, and floods.
And climate change continues to worry scientists, politicians, and business leaders as an existential threat to our civilization.
At number six, a tie between immigration reform and race relations. Neither of these issues appear to be going away soon.
We'll be hearing some fascinating statistics about race and crime during the next hour from the leading GOP contender in the coming California gubernatorial recall election.
At number five, a four-way tie between the economy, the infrastructure bill, supply chain issues, and inflation fears. Supply chain obstacles and seaport congestion are causing delays in production and thus severe shortages in a number of industries.
These include components of all sorts affecting electronic devices and sparking inflation in many areas of the economy.
At number four this week, a tie between the California recall, crime, and homelessness. The coming recall election to oust Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom in California is now a dead heat in the polls as 46 candidates, mostly Republicans, seek to replace him.
The issues of crime and homelessness are two of the big ones, causing Golden State voters to be disgruntled with the present administration.
At number three, the January 6 investigation tied with Trump election fraud claims. The probe of the causes of the events of January 6 continues, with some calling it an organized insurrection and others seeking to minimalize its level of premeditation as simply a spontaneous riot.
But no matter how you splice it and dice it, it all comes down to learning exactly what happened at the White House that day in terms of calls and conversations that could implicate former President Trump's actions and inactions as key factors in the horrific event that resulted in death, destruction, and a stain on American democracy. Meantime, the former president's relentless insistence that the election was stolen from him is creating a schism among Republicans and conservatives.
At number two, the COVID-19 Delta variant, masks and mandates. The spike in cases due to the Delta variant has further fueled debate over masks and vaccine hesitancy, not to mention a growing sense of despair sweeping the nation and the world.
Big news of the week. The FDA has granted full approval to the Pfizer COVID vaccine. Meantime, Governors Abbott of Texas and DeSantis of Florida are doubling down on their vows to make masking mandates illegal against growing opposition from parents, school boards, and voters, according to the polls.
And at number one this week, Afghanistan withdrawal chaos. The suicide bombing of the airport in Kabul at the end of the week, taking the lives of possibly more than 13 U.S. soldiers and scores of Afghans, elevated the level of outrage over the U.S. exit from that war-torn country to deafening levels.
Many see this chain of events as providing terrorist groups, including ISIS, with the opportunity to rebuild and increase their ability to engage in terrorism against the U.S. and its interests throughout the globe. It wasn't a good week. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Let's kick off the interview segment of this week's program with a visit to the great city of Baltimore and a conversation with talk show host Andrew Langer of Heritage Radio Station WBAL. What's your feeling about what's happening in Afghanistan, Andrew?
Well, it is a real mess, and you know it's interesting, of course, because Baltimore is right next to D.C. We have a massive military presence, a massive federal government presence. So anytime you get something like this happening, it causes a stir within our listenership at WBAL. The real fundamental question, of course, is could this have been avoided, and what would have happened if we had followed the original timetable back in May and withdrawn then? What would a President Trump have done differently? And obviously lots of Americans are asking these questions because we're seeing it reflected in the polling data for President Biden. And, you know, they have been in a mad scramble for several days to stem that tide. And, of course, the attack this week outside the military checkpoints, that doesn't help matters at all.
Do you think that this is going to have legs, or do you think this is going to be one of those stories that originally we all wanted to get out of Afghanistan? Both parties were involved in bringing us to that point. Biden is receiving criticism, and deservedly so, for his handling of this. But taking the big picture, we talk about his approval ratings. We're still early in the Biden administration. There is, of course, the consequences in 22, and then we look to 24. Do you think that this whole Afghanistan thing is going to have legs in terms of the political climate and political discussion going forward after the dust settles?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the sort of the fundamental issue these days is how long is the memory of the electorate? And this is something that sort of goes back to the 1992 election, right? Everybody thought that George H.W. Bush was going to coast into victory, given what happened in the Gulf War. And then George H.W. Bush raised taxes, and you know, the public focused on that, and then it voted Bill Clinton into office. I think, you know, there is it's not just this one issue, right? It would be one thing if it was just Afghanistan. But as the economy continues to limp along, as we see the resurgence of COVID in the form of the Delta variant, you know, that is probably the biggest wild card in all of this, is what happens with COVID moving forward, and whether or not the approval of the next two vaccines has the effect of allowing us to move forward and gain some control, whether we see some kind of reemergence of our economy and the normalcy in American lives. But if we are back to, you know, fighting in Afghanistan on a daily basis, and we are still dealing with COVID-19 issues, it's going to be very, very tough for the Democrats to salvage this going into the 2022 midterms.
What do you think is going to happen? I mean, how do you think we're going to do with COVID? What's your personal philosophy? If you were king, what would you tell the people to do?
Well, actually, it's interesting, right? Because if I were king, I would be taking a very different approach to all of this. Obviously, you know, the thing we have to realize is the policy has to change when we understand the problems better. And the key thing here has been these breakthrough cases. I mean, in Maryland, you know, you had a governor, Larry Hogan, who's been all about making sure that people get vaccinated. And then all of a sudden, you know, everybody on the governor's staff is vaccinated, and all of a sudden there are these breakthrough cases. And the reality is we have to focus on what are the real problems. We have to focus on protecting folks who are the most at risk, right? The folks with the so-called comorbidities that are out there. And we have to recognize that just making sure that people are vaccinated is not going to be really the defining factor. The real issue remains the issue of testing here. We now understand this more. For a while, we thought, well, when we get to the vaccinations, we won't have to do all this mass testing. Now it really is going to be about making sure that people are tested, making sure that we understand the relationship between the different kinds of vaccines and the variants that are out there, and understanding this issue of how long the vaccines actually last. Oh, and let's not forget the differentiation between those who've been vaccinated and those who've had COVID and have naturally occurring antibodies. And so we have to create a public policy that reflects all of those things. But this idea of just sort of looking at it one-dimensionally, this is not going to work. If we're only focusing on vaccines and vaccine mandates, this is not going to get us to where we need to be regarding COVID.
Let's pivot now to the other big issue, and that's the January 6th investigation and former President Trump continuing to have rallies and continuing to claim that the 2020 election was fraudulent and stolen from him. What's your position on those issues?
Well, listen here, you know, this is one of the great tragedies in all of this. And it's funny because it also came up in the context, Michael, of pushback against vaccine mandates. I have a real hard time with folks who are not serious about getting to the root of issues, who push lawsuits that actually set back the causes that they're doing, right? There were legitimate questions that were being raised about the way the 2020 election was conducted, especially when it comes to policies in states that were changed without the use of the legislature, without the involvement of the legislatures in contravention of a number of state constitutions. Pennsylvania is a prime example of this. And we got all wrapped around the axle about these fantastical cases of or ideas of software glitches or software changes that were made. And it took away from the real issues that we needed to deal with, which is real election integrity, making sure that there's a real person attached to a vote, making sure that elections can't be stolen through, you know, ballot harvesting, et cetera. And so we've gotten away from those things. And that's, as I said, a great tragedy here, that it sets back the cause of election integrity. The judge in Michigan this week who censured two major national election lawyers, Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood. This sets everything back. But then when it comes to January 6th, right, this issue, we now have this story out of Reuters, of all places. So this is not, you know, Breitbart. This is not the Daily Caller reporting that the FBI sources are saying that there was no coordinated insurrection. And knowing some of the folks who were involved in the January 6th rally, you know that they couldn't organize themselves out of a paper bag, let alone organize an insurrection. But the real issue here is this January 6th commission. And incidentally, this is why the January 6th commission was created, because the Democrats on Capitol Hill know that nobody or very few people out of the hundreds that have been arrested, the hundreds that are languishing in jail right now, very few of them will be charged with insurrection or sedition. because those are very hard cases to prove, and frankly, the evidence just isn't there. So they create this January 6th commission as a way of getting around this. And I'm certain what's going to happen is that nobody is going to be found to have committed sedition, treason, insurrection, whatever you want to call it. But a lot of folks are going to probably get referred to for prosecution for process crimes and paperwork violations. And it's all a way for the Democrats to keep the January 6th issue in the popular mindset to stem all of the other things that are going wrong for the Democrats right now.
That's Andrew Langer of WBAL in Baltimore. Coming up next, a dip into the talker's archives and an excerpt from a conversation I had last year with radio talk show host Larry Elder, who might just be the next governor of California. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the great bands of the golden age of album rock, Gun Hill Road, has been around for more than 50 years. The members of Gun Hill Road are Steve Goldrich, Paul Reich, Glenn Leopold, Brian Coonan, and yours truly, Michael Harrison. I wrote the lyrics to a song on our new album, What Year Is This? It's titled, I Know You're Real. It's about the relationship between human beings and our friends in the animal kingdom.
I know you're real.
Please take a moment to write down the following web address to see the music video of this inspirational song that contains some wonderful animal images that'll rock your heart and soothe your soul. Here's the address. Write it down. IKnowYouAreReal.com. That's IKnowYouAreReal.com. If you love animals, you'll feel real good after seeing this video. IKnowYouAreReal.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. Conservative, Republican, African-American, radio talk show host Larry Elder is all over the news lately as he's become the frontrunner in a field of 46 potential alternatives to Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom in California's forthcoming gubernatorial recall election. I spoke with Elder in the racially turbulent year of 2020 on my podcast about his take on a subject that remains on the Talker's Top 10 Topics list week after week, race relations in America. Let's revisit a timely excerpt from that conversation.
I think that the number one social problem facing this country is the growing number of children raised without fathers. In the black community, almost 73% of kids are raised without fathers, Michael. In 1900, according to certain census tracts I've seen, a black kid was slightly more likely to be born to a mom and dad married than a white kid. Fast forward, and that's completely changed now. In my opinion, what we've done in our country is we've incentivized women to marry the government. We've allowed men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility. When I was in college, 1970, we read a report called The Negro Family, A Case for National Action, written by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who later on became a New York senator, a Democrat.
Yes.
And he said that at the time, 25% of black kids were born outside of wedlock. He thought the number was horrific. It was going to get larger, and it required, quote, national action, close quote. Well, from 25% in 65 to 73% in 2018, that's a huge problem, and you cannot blame that on racism, because by any stretch of the imagination, the country is far less racist now than it was in 1965. It's the perverse incentives that we're providing men and women because of our welfare state. In fact, 25% of white kids now are born outside of wedlock. If that was alarming in 1965 when 25% of black kids were born outside of wedlock, why is it not alarming in 2018 when 25% of white kids are born outside of wedlock? 40% of all kids in America are now born outside of wedlock. And I didn't say this. Barack Obama said a kid raised without a father is 5 times more likely to be poor, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, 20 times more likely to end up in jail. That is the number one far and away social problem that we're facing in this country, and I address it on my show constantly.
Well, it's interesting. You know, just without getting too deep into it, there are women who believe in terms of the feminist movement that there's absolutely no reason why a woman needs a man, and that it's almost glamorized in many in entertainment and in many political circles for a woman to actually publicly announce, I'm going to have a child. And they have a child without a husband or without a father being responsible in the mix. facts. And it is glamorized too. Isn't it interesting how we glamorize things?
It is interesting, Michael. And if you look at it from either the left or the right, whether it's the Brookings Institution, which is a think tank on the left, or a conservative institution like the Heritage Foundation, both of them have done studies on the importance of having a father in your life, and both of them have reached the same conclusion about the importance of a father and the impact not having a father on one's life has. Now, they have different approaches on what to do about it, but the effect of it, both the left and the right seem to agree that not having a father means your kid is going to have a poor outcome in his or her life than if your kid was born under a roof with a mom and a dad. You know, this whole kneeling in the NFL is purportedly about the abuse of black people by the cops. Steve Kerr, one of the coaches for the NBA, recently criticized the NFL for requiring its players to stand on the field. And I said on the air, Michael, all this energy, all this stuff devoted to whether or not players should kneel on the field because of this allegation about police brutality. The biggest problem facing the country is not facing the black community is not the rare instance when an unarmed black man is killed by a white cop. I think in a recent year, according to the Washington Post, it happened 16 times that an unarmed black man was killed by a white cop. There were more unarmed whites killed by cops than unarmed blacks. I defy anybody in the audience that we're talking to name any unarmed white person who was killed. Because when an unarmed white person is killed, nobody gives a rip. When an unarmed black person gets killed, it becomes a cause celeb. There were 12,000 homicides last year. About 6,000 of them were black victims. Almost all of those black victims were killed by another black person, usually a young black person killing another black person. Far and away, more black people are killed by other black people than by white cops. If Keith Kerr really wants to do something, if these guys really want to do something, address the problem in the NBA. A few years ago, Michael, the Sports Illustrated had a cover story called "Where Is My Daddy?" And it was a little kid holding a basketball, and it was about all these kids born outside of wedlock by these players in the NBA. And one ex-player was quoted as saying, for every player that does not have a kid outside of wedlock, there's a player with two. Now, that is a huge social problem, and to the extent that basketball players are role models and therefore influence the behavior of other people who look up to them, what about your own problem in your own league, Mr. Kerr? What about the large number of players in the NBA who have kids outside of wedlock, and what does that do to our society if these players are indeed role models?
That's radio talk show host and GOP frontrunner in the California gubernatorial recall, Larry Elder, talking about his position on race relations in America, excerpted from a conversation I conducted with him last year on my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Another conservative radio talk show host in the news and on the Talkers Top People survey this past week, tied into the pandemic story, is the late Phil Valentine of radio station WWTN-FM in Nashville. Phil died tragically last Saturday at the age of 61 due to contracting a deadly case of COVID-19. The sad irony of this awful event is that prior to it, Phil openly flouted the vaccine, saying he thought the odds of contracting the disease were only about 1%, so he would take his chances and not be inoculated. However, when he fell severely ill, he sent word out to his listeners that he made the wrong call and encouraged everyone to be vaccinated. It's a shame that Phil will be largely remembered for his connection to the COVID story, because he was one of the best talk show hosts of the modern era, a multifaceted filmmaker, best-selling author, and an all-around decent human being. Here's an excerpt from a conversation I had with him in 2017, shortly after Donald Trump was elected and sworn in as president. I know that you're your own man, and I know, having followed your career, that you're independent, and though conservative, and though openly pro-Trump, I gather that if Trump started to do things that you did not like, that you would not seek victory as opposed to truth, and that you would criticize him. Am I correct?
Oh, absolutely. And we were talking about with this latest budget battle. I'm going, you know, where are all these cuts? I mean, Trump is out there talking about how wonderful we got to pass this budget. I'm going, you know, where's the wall? Where are the cuts to all of these agencies you were talking about doing? Where you talked about cutting money for Planned Parenthood. You talked about cutting money for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Where is all that? It's not there. And he's saying on the other side, well, we got all this money for the military. And then my question is, well, how are we going to pay for that? I mean, we you know, we've either got to increase taxes or reduce spending, and he's not doing either one right now. I mean, and I'm not for increasing taxes, obviously, but if we're going to increase spending for the military, which I have no problem with that, we're going to have to find the money somewhere else. And it seems to me this is just another case of running up the deficit and the debt, which is going to catch up with us.
Do you believe that basically, in terms of broad strokes philosophy, that decreasing taxes on business boosts the economy, which creates more revenue ultimately for the government by having more tax because there's more circulation and income being produced?
Yeah, I've actually gone back and actually looked at the revenue to the federal government in times that we've raised taxes, times that we've cut taxes. And every time we've cut taxes, we've seen a spur in the economy. See, it's not that people are paying more in taxes, like they're going to tax you more. They tax you less. But if we have more people working with better jobs, and that's the key, we have so many people now that are working, and I've heard this since the Great Recession. Yeah, I'm working, but I'm not working in the job that I wanted or that I was or that I want to be working in. If we can get people back producing at the level they were producing before the recession, then you see the money to the Treasury come in. But here's a good warning for Congress is what happened during the 1980s. If they passed Reagan's budgets, and I've done research on this as well, if they passed Reagan's budgets instead of the Democrats' budgets during the 1980s, we'd have had a balanced budget in 1989. As it was, we had Tip O'Neill outspending and outstripping the prosperity. So, yeah, we get more money coming in. We doubled the coffers from 1980 to 1990, but we outspent that. So if we're not curtailing the spending side of it, it doesn't matter how much we stimulate the economy and how much money we got coming in. We're still going down the road of ruin because of the deficits and the debt. And right now we're paying about 9 cents on the dollar to service the debt. That's the interest. The experts are telling me that within the next 20 years or so on this same track that we're on, we'll be spending 30 to 40 cents a dollar. So imagine that, Michael. I mean, we're talking now, whether you're liberal, whether you're conservative, whether you're pro-defense, whether you're pro-social programs, we'll be arguing over 60% of the money because 40% of it's going to be going to service the debt. And I think that's something that all of us on all sides of the spectrum need to be aware of. That's coming down the pike if we don't get control of spending.
Well, it would be nice if all people on all sides of the issue of all issues work together for mutual benefit. That doesn't seem to be the tone of the times. When you are critical of Trump on your program, do you get negative blowback from your listeners? Do you find yourself, as many conservative hosts have had to deal with for the past year during the campaign and now during the Trump presidency, of having to deal with Trump zealots who comprise a large part of the talk radio audience?
Yeah, I do. And that's a problem because I tell people, you know, I'm calling balls and strikes. I'm just telling you what is the truth. And if Trump does something and it's a strike, it's a ball, I'm going to call it. If he strikes out, I'm going to tell you. But I want these people to understand that I use logic and common sense. I take the emotion out of it. And that's what I've always criticized the left about, is being too emotional. Emotion can bring you to a problem, but I don't believe it can ever solve a problem. You have to be calm and collected and use logic to solve the problem. If you're going to be hysterical anytime anybody criticizes your president, President Trump, then you're never going to be able to see him for what he is, which is a human being. And you've got to understand that he's going to make mistakes. And when he makes mistakes, it's up to us, certainly those of us who voted for him, to remind him of why we put him in office. And the same thing with the Republicans. And, you know, you can't just go along to get along or be blinded by it. And that's what we've accused the left of doing for so many years, of being blindly following Hillary or Obama or whatever. You can't do the same thing on the other side.
I find it's part of the culture today, and it's not just even in politics. It's in sports. It's in life in general, that we seem to be more interested, and I'm not talking about any individual, just a cultural thing, more interested in achieving victory than in finding truth. And, you know, you certainly see that in sports. You know, people will criticize the rival team for having a wife beater on its roster, but they look the other way when that great player is on the roster of their team. That's a very good example of what I mean. And I do find that politics to many has become a sport in which your ego is invested in it. It becomes a personal investment as opposed to necessarily an independent quest to find the truth. And I find this to be happening more and more and more as I observe the culture of our times. What's your reaction to that observation?
Well, the three most difficult words in the English language for anybody are "I am wrong." People never want to admit that they're wrong, and you've got to be able to say, "Hey, I screwed up. Hey, I own this. I was wrong on this or whatever." And it doesn't mean that necessarily you were wrong for voting for Trump or wrong for voting for Hillary or whatever. But when these people do something that you know in your heart is not what they're supposed to be doing, whether it's a Republican Congress, a Democrat Congress, or whatever, you have to be big enough to say they're wrong, or if I went along with this, I am wrong. And people don't want to have backed the wrong horse. They get so emotionally invested in this, and I think that social media has exacerbated that. It's magnified because now you're on record on Facebook as I was for this person, that person. I said this. And then you want to double down on it because you don't want to admit that you're wrong. And you just, at some point, you got to cut bait and say, "Hey, I went down the wrong path on this." Now, very rarely happens to me, Michael, because I'm never wrong. But I mean, I'm just pointing out who might have this problem.
That's the late Phil Valentine, a high-profile, extremely popular conservative talk show host heard for many years on WWTN-FM in Nashville, who tragically died last week due to COVID-19. This conversation was excerpted from my podcast interview with Phil recorded back in 2017 and presented as a salute to his memory. You know, Phil Valentine really practiced what he preached. On his deathbed, he sent the word to all of his listeners and to the entire nation, "I was wrong. Please go get vaccinated." Meantime, he's in the headlines all around the country, tying him, of course, to his ironic connection to COVID-19 and the vaccine issue. And he's telling, "I was wrong. Please go get vaccinated." Interesting to know that after listening to his whole conversation recorded 4 years ago about his view on admitting when you're wrong, which really is the key to eventually finding the truth. It took a lot of courage, and it proves that he was an honest and brave human being. We need more of that. Coming up next, a visit to small-town America and a conversation with a radio talk show host who's also the sitting mayor of the city in which he broadcasts. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap.
This report is brought to you by Genesis 2 Project, G2P. Recently, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI, released a preliminary report on possible threats posed by UFOs, now known as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, UAP, and the progress the Department of Defense UAP Task Force has made in understanding any threats. Dr. J.C. Van Valkenburg is a former Los Alamos National Lab biophysicist who has been working with G2P to bring scientifically sound UAP data to the public.
G2P has released the first scientifically authenticated documentation of UAPs, including images captured with infrared technology. Primo Forensics performed the digital forensic analysis.
In tandem with the ODNI report, these data support the development of relevant processes, policies, technologies, and training for the U.S. military and government personnel upon encountering UAP. Visit Genesis2Project.com.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. There are lots of colorful mayors and former mayors floating around America. People like Rudy Giuliani, Pete Buttigieg, Bill de Blasio, and Lori Lightfoot, to name just a handful. But stand by for a conversation with a really interesting mayor whom you probably never heard of. His name is Scott James Matheson, and he's the longtime morning talk show host at Talk 92.1 WDDQ in the small city of Valdosta, Georgia. He's been on the air there for almost 20 years. and he was elected mayor in 2020. How do you deal with integrating the larger picture of the world with the microcosm of Valdosta, Georgia?
It's tough on a presidential level because it does sound partisan, does sound like partisan bickering. But it's easier when it's something as obvious as Afghanistan. When you make that kind of faux pas, I think universally both sides of the aisle are saying, you screwed up, you're a bonehead. I'm waiting for the generals to speak up and say, he's a bonehead and didn't listen to us. This is such a bad situation. It is very polarizing, and I can attack something like that.
Do you have Republican and Democratic parties in Valdosta, or is it like some cities where it's no parties, each individual runs? How does that work?
So it's nonpartisan for the city politics, correct. Mm-hmm. I'm running as a nonpartisan, but obviously I wear my partisanship on my sleeve. It's a conservative area, deep south. Mm-hmm. It's a conservative talk lineup as well. My focus has always been the city and what we have going on, the city events. My 750 guests I put through that studio every single year reflect that, because they're all walks of life, all charity, all government, all everything. So my focus, yes, for 3 hours, but then outside that, I am carrying a conservative lineup for sure.
How does a character like, and I say a character because she is a character, you know, either love her, hate her, or but you've heard of her, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a prominent Georgian. How's she doing? First of all, how far are you from her district, and how is she doing in terms of her profile and popularity or lack thereof in your city?
Yeah, she's so polarizing. It's no fun to listen to. It's no fun. It's kind of like our former president. I thought he was doing wonderful work. I thought he was his own worst enemy. And surely on his exit, he became his own worst enemy. And he became ours. Because now there's kind of a political statement I've heard for the 50th time in the state of Georgia. You can't make it through the primary without him. You can't win with him. You can't win the general with him. So, anybody in that conservative bent is wondering how they run again, how they run for the election. It's going to be tough.
Hmm. So some call it he has a death grip on the GOP. Have you ever heard that term increasingly used? And I can understand that. How's the popularity of your neighboring governor, Ron DeSantis? He's going through his own turmoil right now, wrestling with the political benefits and deficits of having a stance on COVID. What's the view from over the border, over the Florida-Georgia border of Ron DeSantis?
Well, I'll tell you, we're only an hour and 40 minutes from Tallahassee, the capital of that fine state. Mm-hmm. I know that state. I know Ron DeSantis very well, and I think he's done an excellent job until we got delivered to this point. When the world opened up and we all said, I was denied my vacation last summer, I'll be damned, I'm going to take it this summer, they dogpiled Florida, and Florida becomes an epicenter. They become one out of every five cases in America are coming out of that state because, again, tourism is their base. The world descended on them during those 2 months that we opened up. And I thought he needed to shift. Nice to have a hardline stance. Nice to be the champion in the conservative movement. But boy, you got to look beyond your nose and say, my state's in trouble. And I didn't think he shifted fast enough. I believe he's starting to. I know he's had some battles with the school boards and the school system throughout his state, but Michael, I think it's time to say we have to move as our people are dying, as our people were infected. And I'll give you a quick little example. My city, the racial makeup of my city is 53% African-American. So as I move to shut down my city hall buildings, as I move to make a mandate or two, I have to do it because 53% of my population, only 8% of them chose to get vaccinated. So I have to move to protect them, whether it's my belief in the opposite direction or not, whether I want to say, boy, I'm uncomfortable in a mask, I have to move to protect that bunch. So there's just no other way to view it.
That's the mayor of Valdosta, Georgia, and the morning show host at Talk 92.1 WDDQ in that city, Scott James Matheson. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Okay, we have time for one more. Let's pay tribute to the great Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts, who passed away this week at the age of 80. Joining us is our international woman in the nation's capital, Victoria Jones.
It's really a milestone. He's one of the greats. You know, there are, when somebody like that goes, it nobody expected it to be Charlie Watts. Everybody expected it to be Keith Richards, really, because everybody's surprised that Keith Richards is still alive. And Charlie Watts was the quiet one. Charlie Watts was the one who only went off the rails in the 80s. Otherwise, he always, at the end of concerts, just went back to his room and he used to sketch his bed. He didn't have girls back to his room. He was faithful to his wife most of his life. He just sketched every bed in every hotel he ever stayed in.
What do you mean he sketched his bed? Is that a British term I'm not familiar with, or did he?
No,
he drew a
it's
picture.
Literal. He was a graphic designer, and he went back to the hotel room and he used to sketch his surroundings.
That's interesting. So imagine all of those sketchings would have some value today from a contemporary cultural level, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So much about him. His sartorial elegance. He was often voted among the best dressed men in the world. Mm. His the way he always turned himself out in beautiful suits and ties, no matter what everybody else was wearing. There's bound to be an exhibition of his clothes, if it's permitted, because he was smart, always smart. And he was a great drummer. And he was low key. He sort of competed with others in a way for the low key award of the year. Very different from Jagger.
It's interesting that you mention his clothing. Brings back memories, of course, when the Rolling Stones burst upon the scene shortly after the Beatles, and I'm talking from a U.S. perspective. There was the Beatles, and then there was the British Invasion, and the next big group to follow them was the Stones. And the Beatles wore these very, very, well-tailored mod suits. They had the narrow ties and the little lapels, and they all looked the same. And the haircuts, even though they were outlandishly long-haired, they suddenly looked like they were, out of GQ when the Stones popped up on the scene, and they had even longer hair than the Beatles, and it was scraggly, and they were kind of ugly in an attractive way, and they all dressed differently. And when they popped up on the Ed Sullivan Show, each one dressed differently. That was kind of like, whoa, they're a band and they dress differently. Because back before the Rolling Stones became popular, most bands had some kind of a uniform. Do you recall, how they looked, those bands?
Yeah, that was how the managers and the promoters seemed to want them to be. But no, the Stones deliberately cultivated this image of individuality, and that was new.
Yeah, very much so. And so much so that it's one of the few areas that the Beatles followed the Stones. In most cases, the Stones followed the Beatles. And there's all sorts of chronologies and histories and analysis of that, the relationship between the Beatles and their arch rivals, if you will. On one level, the very, very crude and badder boy group, the Stones, and to the right of them, the very, very slick and polished Dave Clark Five that made the Beatles look like bad boys. And I'm sure you remember the Dave Clark Five.
Oh, absolutely remember the Dave Clark Five. Yeah. And of course, at some point, the Beatles decided to go off into a different direction and to stop all dressing the same.
Oh, yeah.
They just went off in their own directions. They were big enough. They could just do that.
Right. And a lot of that came after Sgt. Pepper, which had them in as their alter egos, the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, with all of those outrageous costumes that the Beatles wore. It was such a colorful time. Now, an interesting thing about Charlie Watts and the Rolling Stones, now that Charlie is gone, the remaining Stones are Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Ronnie Wood. Ronnie Wood used to be with the Faces with Rod Stewart, and that's why since Ronnie Wood joined the Stones. The Stones sound a little bit like the old Faces band with Rod Stewart.
Yeah.
You know, I think of the song Stay With Me, which sounds like Rod Stewart singing lead for the Rolling Stones. It's sort of that transitional period there. But there was Brian Jones. There was Mick Taylor. There was, of course, until recently, bass player Bill Wyman, who was also called the Quiet One. The Stones have been able to, just like The Who did it, Led Zeppelin never did it, but The Who did it and so many other bands did it. They were able to function without their original lineup and still maintain the integrity, the cultural integrity of the group itself. Whereas there's no way the Beatles could have made it with any one member of the four not being there. It was John, Paul, George, and Ringo, done. But most people could not name all the members of the Rolling Stones, even though the Stones are, you know, academically as popular in terms of fame and celebrity as the Beatles or any other rock band. That's an interesting phenomenon, I guess, more attributable to the Beatles than the Stones. Have you ever thought about that?
I haven't thought about it that way, but now thinking about, you know, Jagger and Richards had feuds. I mean, they were feuding for decades. They made a number of albums where they refused to be in the studio at the same time. And during that time, Charlie Watts didn't care. He would be in the studio with one or the other or both. But they were feuding. People don't know. It sounds like everybody's in the studio together and all getting along, but that wasn't the case.
It's very, very difficult, considering the psychological and sociological dynamics of a band, for a band to stay together very long because of petty jealousies, differences of opinion, both artistically and business-wise. And sometimes they just get on each other's nerves. And the fact that the Stones have stayed together in any form, or more specifically, that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards have stayed together so long, is a tribute to some type of cooperativeness, although you bring up something that I didn't realize. I never found the Stones as interesting as I found the Beatles or some of the other bands, and I don't know why. But the fact that there was that dynamic between Jagger and Richards, I find extremely, extremely interesting. Now, I heard somewhere, I don't know how true it is, I think I read it either this morning before we got together for this conversation or last evening, and it's one of those headlines that you catch, but you don't know the story, that Charlie Watts took a swing, actually punched Mick Jagger. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, Charlie Watts, who was low-key, got along with everybody and was just, he was fine with it all. And you know, he was treated like a hired hand most of the time. 1984, they were in Amsterdam. Jagger and Richards went out drinking, came back to the hotel around 5 a.m. Jagger calls Watts on the phone and wakes him up, says, "Where's my drummer?" Watts is furious. 20 minutes later, Watts shows up at Jagger's hotel room, beautifully dressed, furious, shaved, dressed, suit and tie, and says, "Never call me your bleeping drummer again. You're my bleeping singer." And then grabs him, delivers a right hook. And Keith Richards says he just about saves Jagger from falling out of a window into a canal.
That's the executive director of the DC Radio Company, Victoria Jones. And this has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at the past week of Monday, August 23rd through Friday, August 27th, 2021. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of The Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in conjunction with Talkers Magazine and Talk Media Network. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.